99-2987, Peterson versus Midwest Security Insurance Company, arguing for the petitioner, plaintiff Danny R. Peterson. Mr. O'Tier.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Dan Rotier. I represent the appellant, Danny Peterson. The underlying facts are quite simple. There are three players. Danny Peterson is the plaintiff who was injured while using a tree stand. The owners of the real property, farmers whose last name was also Peterson, no relation. It's 122 acres, mainly woods. And the third player, Mr. Shaw, who is insured by Midwest, and Midwest is the defendant. The other named parties, some of which are insurance carriers, are subrogated parties. As you know, the trial judge dismissed this case on the basis of recreational immunity, and that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals, and we are here on the granting of a petition to review. I know that in the last term you spent a fair amount of time on recreational immunity, and although I'm not a mind reader, my sense was at least some of you were looking for bright lines with respect to the definition of who was a recreational user. Fortunately, that is not an issue in this case. There is no question but that the appellant, Danny Peterson, was engaged in a recreational activity, namely bow hunting from a tree stand. By way of facts, he fell, he was rendered paraplegic, and brought claims for those injuries. I think, as the briefs would indicate, we see there being two issues. What is the definition of property, and does it include this portable tree stand? And second, was Harold Shaw an occupant of the property? And I think those are interspersed, and I think as all appellate courts are wont to do, you are clearly interested in doing justice to these particular litigants, but I think you're also should be looking for a bright line as it relates to these issues, because I think there are a multitude of problems in the Court of Appeals opinion, starting with its definition of structure. If you refer to the Court of Appeals opinion, the Court essentially adopted two definitions from dictionaries. But those definitions are so expansive that it includes anything man-made, anything constructed. It would include not only a deer stand, a swing, it would include a gun, it would include a car, it would include any man-made object. The Court did not limit its definition of structure as having needing to have anything to do with real property whatsoever.
So your position would be that a tree stand, which by very definition of a stand being something that was constructed, would be a structure?
Yes, Justice. Yeah. We do not dispute that.
Yes.
And we did not bring that issue before you in the petition for review.
You also look at the, and of course, I think that since this is under 895.52, the nature of the activity, what was being done out there?
We can see it was a recreational use.
Yep.
The two issues really are, is a piece of personal property not permanently attached to real property by someone other than the owner of the real property, does that result in immunity to the owner of the personal property, even if he is no longer an occupier of the property?
There's a certain, in deer hunting, and it's noted, I think, in your brief, obviously, I don't know if we want to take judicial notice, but it has seasons. So other than going out and inspecting or building, which is usually not done during the seasons are the time of, quote, occupancy And as I understand, I want to get the facts here, that Harold Shaw built this structure a number of years, and I couldn't find in the brief exactly when he did it, but I know that it was not used by Mr. Shaw. It was used by Mr. Peterson with permission of Mr. Shaw, if I understand this correctly, in 96 and in 97. Is that correct?
I think the record shows that Mr. Shaw built it at least 3 years prior to the accident and had not used it in those 3 years. That Mr. Peterson had used it in the year before his accident,
right,
and was commencing use at the time. I think this is, I think there is a logical bright line, if you will, that we can arrive at.
I'm very interested in that bright line. I need a little clarification. You mentioned earlier, even though not an occupant of the property, what property are you referring to? The tree stand as property, or the real property as property, when you say even though not an occupant of the property?
Well, as you and the balance of the court knows, there's a statutory definition of owner of property, rather, and it's defined as real property and buildings, structures, and improvements thereon. It's our contention that when the word property is used in the statute, it is limited to that definition, and that, if I may jump ahead a bit, there may have been points in time when Mr. Shaw did have immunity under the recreational statute. For example, at the point when he constructed the stand and was erecting it and using it, it could be argued, I think forcefully, that he was an occupier, not just of the personal property item, but also the real property. And that as an occupier, he had immunity because now the property he was occupying included the real property. And it might be said, as I think Justice Wilcox was alluding to, with respect to a deer stand, there might be times when there are absences from it because of deer hunting season. But in this instance, we have a 3-year relinquishment of use of it by Mr. Shaw. And it's my contention and our contention that the owner of a piece of personal property left on a piece of real property which he does not own loses his status as an occupier of the real property, even though he continues to be the owner, in fact, of the personal property. So, for example, if someone pitched a tent with permission on someone's property, they would fit the definition of occupier, and they would be occupying real property as well as the piece of personal property which they brought with them. When they remove their tent and they're back in their home, they lose the status of occupier, I believe, even though they retain ownership of the tent.
But here, counsel, just if we follow your facts, that tree stand was there, taking your version, at least 4 years, 3 years before, and then, of course, the year of the fall, which was in 97. So the tree stand was never moved from the property, and it stayed there. And Mr. Shaw, as I understand it, in the year of 97, was this may or may not be an issue, but when Danny Peterson asked to use it, Shaw said, "Well, how is it?" And he said, "It looked good." Wasn't that in 97 when he supposedly said that? So he never. When you talk about occupancy, there wasn't abandonment here. It was still this property on this recreational piece. In other words, I hate to use the word inextricably linked, but aren't they linked together? Like to get to this property, you couldn't fly, and he'd had to walk over the Peterson property. And it was the Peterson tree in which the property was located, tied to.
And if I follow your reasoning, Justice Wilcox, it would mean that if we accept the testimony that Mr. Shaw, sometime in the fall of 97, visited the tree stand, looked up at it, made an observation, and thereafter told Danny Peterson, in the presence of others, that it looked good. The question arises, is that a use of it such that he resumed his definition of occupier? For example, did that mean, certainly it's an indicator of ownership of the tree stand, I'll grant you that, but it's our contention that is not an occupation, to use the statutory definition, of the real property and the structure thereof. It was an observation of it. We would be faced, I think, with a different situation if Mr. Shaw hunted on that deer stand, whether the same day or the previous week or the same season. I think the court would then have to draw a line. But here we have a three-year period, at least, of non-usage of the deer stand and the associated real property that's necessary for the hunting. So as I see this, members of the court, Mr. Shaw did not enjoy the status of an occupier of the real property at the time of this accident, even though he was the owner of the structure which remained on it. If, and I think there are some reasons why this makes sense, if someone can place personal property on real property, utilize it and enjoy immunity, and then abandon it, that does nothing to encourage the use of opening of lands. It results in abandoned personal property, whether it's a tree stand or an abandoned car or a lost gun.
So that was my question. So you're because he didn't actually climb up, or but he went out and he said, look, tree stand. But it just seems to me with the whole idea of the statute that that's going to cause some interesting situations. If you actually have to, in order to occupy, you have to say, this is my stand. I mean, can you imagine what Brightline rule are we saying? This is my stand. I'm too old to climb up on it, but it's still mine. Or I don't hunt anymore. Or it just seems it would be difficult to have a bright line.
And I'm more concerned about not drawing a line somewhere, because it would mean, if you accept the definition of structure, as indicated by the Court of Appeals, that someone can leave personal property on recreational land. They have no obligation to maintain it, inspect it, use it, and yet, at some later date, someone is injured from that property, the duty of reasonable care is waived. Although this court and other courts have said this statute is to be liberally construed, that's in terms of encouraging landowners to allow people on their property to recreate. That was done in this case. Mr. and Mrs. Peterson, the non-related Petersons, opened their land. No claim was ever made against them. This claim was limited to the person who built, erected, did not use for at least 3 years, and then represented it to be safe. That is the extent of the claim in this case. And I think it's troublesome if the court were to allow this ruling to stand in terms of continuing immunity for people who I don't think are entitled to it, people who are not engaged in the occupation of the real property. I think, I'm not going to repeat the argument about the grammar and how this was drafted, but I think a fair reading of the statute is that the terms buildings, structures, and improvements are modifiers of real property. And absent occupation or ownership of the real property, mere ownership of a building or structure does not result in immunity.
Well, counsel, what if we were to change the facts just a bit, and Mr. Shaw was present in the tree stand with Mr. Peterson at the time of Mr. Peterson's injury? Our second scenario was not present on the day, but was present the day before. He was hunting, and then the next day he found Mr. Shaw.
I think we would be in the same position as, I think it was the Lions Club or one of the fraternal organizations which had abandoned its festivities and was found to no longer be an occupier. In your scenario, I think Mr. Shaw would be an occupier because he would be not only exercising the ownership of his piece of personal property, but he would be occupying the real property. And so that he would fit the definition of an owner of property. Owner including occupier, property defined as real property along with the structures attached to it. But just as in the case I've referred to, where the festivities on the lake ended, that entity lost its privileged status, its immune status, because it was no longer occupying.
Why was Shaw no longer occupying it? What's your argument there?
The argument is that it had not, by his own, by the missions in the record, he had not utilized it for its stated purpose, which is hunting, for at least three seasons.
But so then, arguably, he had occupied it 4 years ago, but not 3 years ago. Isn't that the very nature of tree stands in the state of deer stands, and sometimes you go there and sometimes you don't?
That may well be, but I think the question is, should those people who erect them on property owned by others be excused from the duty of reasonable care? It is not Mr. Shaw who opened this property to deer hunting. That was Mr. Peterson, Vernon Peterson. It was Mr. Shaw who invited Mr. Danny Peterson to utilize his piece of personal property.
Mr. Shaw had permission to allow me, just so I have it correctly. This isn't an interval, but Mr. Shaw had this relationship with the Petersons for a number of years. In other words, he was, I believe, raised like their son. But he also brought your client this property. He said you could come and hunt on this property.
That's correct, and that is all consistent with allowing Vernon and Colleen Peterson immunity, because it's appropriate, according to the legislature, to encourage them to open up their properties.
But when you invite somebody, at least at one point in time, you're saying Mr. Shaw he was never an occupant. When did he stop being an occupant? He was not an occupant when he came out and said, that's my stand and it's okay, because he didn't actually use it. That's what you're saying, he had to use it.
I think his status as an occupier under the statute, which was sufficient to give him immunity, ended when he stopped regular usage of it. For example, the definition of occupier is linked inextricably to the definition of property. And property is defined as real property, along with the building structures and improvements thereon. He was not using the real, in the occasion when he looked at it and told Danny Peterson, or he looked at it and then reported to Danny Peterson, he was not utilizing the real property for the recreational purpose of hunting. He was doing an inspection, it could be argued. And that is not a recreational function. And I think, so it's different from Mr. Shaw having been out there perhaps the weekend before and engaging in hunting and arguing that a week later he's no longer an occupier. It's a much harder our issue.
Well, you know, this, say often here, this case is whatever we decide to go beyond this case, and I'm just thinking what impact from just a policy standpoint and the expectation that there is a recreation and court immunity for occupants, and now we're asked to draw this rather fine line, I think, based on what we're saying is that they would have to actually physically occupy the stand in order to have that moniker occupant put on them. You can't just go out there and say to someone, this is my stand, you can use it.
I think this court has already accepted the notion that occupancy doesn't last forever. Occupancy lasts during the period of usage.
Well, it would have left, you know, the argument could be, well, that may be true if no one was there. And then Mr. Peterson, your client, went up there. But here there was at least some contact with the builder of that structure who had permission. Maybe I'm missing something, but
I don't think you're missing something, but I'd suggest that you're drawing a very fine line. Let's suppose instead of Mr. Shaw observing from the ground the tree stand, he merely represented at somebody's house to Mr. Peterson, it's fine. Okay. Would the fact that he observed it make the difference as to whether he's an occupier? I think his status as occupier is interwoven with whether he meets the definition of owner, which is defined in terms of real property. I don't think merely looking up at a tree stand puts him in the position of occupier. Because if that were true, it wouldn't matter whether he owned a tree stand or not. I looked up at someone else's tree stand, and I'm on the property with permission. Am I an occupier? Even though I've not exercised any usage of it?
Does he have the right to keep other people out of the tree stand?
Whatever right he had, it's subordinate to that of the owners of the property.
But suppose I saw it, decided I wanted to photograph deer, and I went up it. I may be trespassing. Am I covered by the law? Take away. Suppose I'm walking on the land. A photograph. I'm going to use my bow and arrow. Am I covered by the recreation immunity law, even if I'm a trespasser?
The landowner would certainly have immunity.
All right.
The issue of Mr. Shaw's immunity would rest on whether he meets the definition of occupier,
so now
whether he does it with your permission or not.
Sorry, that's not supposed to happen.
As long as it's not a reaction to something I said.
Okay. So, suppose Mr. Shaw goes there every weekend, and I go there without his permission on the weekday. Mr. Shaw have immunity?
It has to do with the nature of the circumstances alone. That doesn't lend itself to a right line.
Suppose Mr. Shaw was said, I haven't used him for 2 years, but it was my intent to use him next year when my leg is perfectly healed.
I wouldn't include intent as a factor. I would not include intent as a factor. I would look at actual usage.
How often? Once a year? Once a year, twice a year?
I think it's tied into the nature of its normal usage, and to me, deer hunting is an annual event. In that circumstance, it might be appropriate to grant him occupier status if he used it yearly. But it wouldn't be reasonable to grant someone occupier status if they abandon a vehicle on somebody's property for a year, and then they claimed immunity because they own the vehicle and they're occupying the property.
Counsel, the whole idea of the recreational immunity statute is, I mean, this is 895.52 is for this activity. You're conceding that. But it seems to me that we're going to be, this is very, very difficult unless we come up with something that's fairly clear. And I'm still a little bit perhaps puzzled by how we would draw that line, because here I see a person who went out to the stand. There may be an argument that 3 years ago I gave you permission, I haven't been out there, and I don't know anything about it, but now this person actually went there, and you seem to say that you need usage, and that's going to be very, very, as Justice Babbage indicated, tree stands are only generally used during the season, and then only occasionally. Somebody doesn't occupy these on a regular basis, and that's what's troubling me, just how we would draw this.
I'm short of time, but let me try to state it as clearly as I can. We know that the property owner, the real property owner, enjoys immunity for structures and buildings improvement on the real property, even though they don't own the structures and buildings and improvements. The issue is whether to extend immunity, carte blanche, to an owner of personal property who places it with permission on the real property, who concededly is immune to some extent while using it. And the issue is, at what point does that immunity disappear? And our contention is, under the facts of this case, that immunity had disappeared because of the three-year absence of usage. And I'd suggest there's a logic to it, because unless you enforce the concept of an absence of regular use, it would allow structures, which is anything made by man under the Court of Appeals opinion, to be left on recreational property with no one at all responsible for it. Again, whether it be something dangerous or not dangerous.
Justice Burley, the threshold question in your analysis in this case is, I think, the definition of property and whether or not it can be broken up into two or three definitions. You advance two definitions. He is persistent. You advance two definitions, and that's the premise of your argument why you get to occupying. Is that correct?
Well, inasmuch as the definition of property is interwoven with the definition of occupier, that is correct. And we have to persuade you on both points that this tree stand, when not in use, regular use, does not fit the definition of property. And frankly, the grammatical context is fairly clear, albeit what the Court of Appeals said in the Doan case, in somewhat of a superfluous comment. I think it's clear that property is real property with the items built on it. Argument is that ownership of a piece of personal property, standing alone, does not meet the definition of property. That to evaluate whether the owner of a piece of personal property meets the definition of occupier requires an analysis of whether the property meets the definition of property, which includes an association with the real property. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Montier. Mr. Moore, representing the defendant respondent, Midwest Security Insurance Company.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Mr. Montier and I agreed beforehand we were going to keep it short. The noise and everything else may not be possible today. I'm a little bit bothered by the fact that an issue of abandonment of the property has come up, but the issue of abandonment wasn't raised in the trial court or in the Court of Appeals. There is admittedly some confusion as to how long Mr. Shaw used that tree stand, and we're hampered by the fact that this lawsuit wasn't commenced until after Mr. Shaw died. And so we never did have the chance to ask him how long he used the property. What Mr. Rotier is referring to is a recollection from the deposition of Mr. Shaw's grandfather that he recalls that Mr. Shaw hadn't used the property for hunting for 2 or 3 years. And if there was an issue of abandonment of this tree stand, we probably would have gone into that at the trial court level, but didn't. Certainly that's not what the trial court found. The trial court noted that Shaw had been out there even as early as that hunting season, because their claim, of course, is based on the fact that Shaw was out there to hunt that very year, looked at the tree stand, cleaned it off, and pronounced it okay for his client to use. So we know that Mr. Shaw was out there that day.
That was in 97.
97, right. He was out there that year. We know that the tree stand had been up for a number of years, and I suspect it was a lot longer than 3 years. But again, this is one of those questions we never did ask Mr. Shaw because he had passed away. But the tree stand had been up there for quite a few years in the woods, and we know that Shaw had used it. And we have the grandfather's speculation that perhaps he had not used it for 2 or 3 years, but we do know that Shaw maintained the tree stand. That's what the trial court said in its decision, page 17, and this is from the appellant's record at 127. Shaw constructed and installed the tree stand a number of years prior to the accident. He also maintained the tree stand on Peterson's land over a period of several years, including at the time of the accident. The tree stand was permanently affixed to the land, not temporarily. So the court found that there was a sufficient continuity of use to constitute an occupier. And recall that the definition of occupier does not require somebody to be there all the time. That's what the Justice Evans said in that Snow Eagles case in the federal court, which was adopted by our Court of Appeals later on. He says that you don't have to be there continuously. You don't have to be there regularly. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the notion of the term occupier. Occupier means, and in the case of the Snow Eagles decision, it meant someone who had made an improvement on the property and who maintained the improvement. That was a snowmobile club who was not out there using it. They made the improvements, some moguls on the property, some grooming of the property, and they maintained it. And that was all that was necessary to constitute an occupier. And certainly, certainly we have at least that much in this case. Mr. Shaw constructed this structure, assembled it permanently to the tree, fixed it to the tree, and maintained it, we know, on a regular basis, and used it, in fact, in the past.
Your opposing counsel suggested that we have been engaged in a hunt for bright lines involving this statute, which is an understatement. As I see the two ends of the continuum here, one, the bright line is that an owner of personal property is always an occupant. That's one way we could go. The other way we could go is that is taken on a case-by-case basis, as I think is suggested by your counsel, and say that the owner of a property may or may not be the occupant, depending upon the facts of the case. Are you advocating one end of the continuum, the bright line, or are you advocating something in between as a standard that we would articulate in this opinion?
Let me try and explain what I'm articulating. First of all, let me point out that I don't think his test, where you have to decide in this continuum how much use there is over any given period of time, I certainly don't think that's a bright line test. I don't think we even have to get to the definition of occupier, because it's unquestioned that the tree stand itself was property. If you want a bright line test, here it is. The statute says no owner or employer, officer, or agent of an owner is liable for the death or injury to anyone caused by a person engaging in a recreational activity on the owner's property. Period. That's what the statute says. This was property. This was unquestionably property under the Dome case and the statutes of the state of Wisconsin. He was on our property. End of inquiry.
Well, that's not the way I understand his argument. I understand his argument saying that if, in fact, we find this as property, that does not end our inquiry, because we still have to determine if he was an owner, if Mr. Shaw was an owner. And under the definition of owner, there has to be, he can be an occupant, and that he was not an occupant. He was not an owner.
Let me quote from their brief, page 7. Page 7 of their brief. It is undisputed that Shaw owned the tree stand. Undisputed that Shaw owned the tree stand.
So, I think the threshold question lies in the definition of property. And as I understand the difference between the two positions, one, your opposing counsel would suggest that in looking at the definition of property in sub F, that buildings, structures, and improvements is not a separate category of property, but rather is part of the category which includes real property. Your opposing counsel reads sub F as setting up two categories: real property, which can have structures and buildings on it. That's one. The second category, dealing with the waters. You, however, read sub F as setting up three categories. Number one is real property. The second category is building structures and improvements. And the third category is waters. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's not only how I read it, that's how the Court of Appeals reads it.
Do you believe that sub F is ambiguous?
No.
Let me then focus you on questions of punctuation. I know this sounds elementary, but I'll tell you, this is what I had to do to go through for me, so I don't mean to suggest why these questions that I'm asking that you're elementary. I just suggest my mind is elementary. So, Billy jumps and runs. There's a conjunction and no comma. Is that correct?
Right.
Billy jumps, runs, and plays. Three things now. What's the rule with regard to a list of three things?
Well, the rule is you put a comma after the first, and you have the option of putting a comma after the second before the conjunction.
Okay. Let's look at the definition of property. Where is the comma in sub F?
It's after the word thereon.
Which would mean the end of the first thing. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the first thing, the first definition of property, property means, number one, first, real property and building structure and says improvements thereon, comma, and the waters of the state.
Right.
Oh. So that sets up two definitions, not three.
Right. If I think that's with all due respect, kind of splitting a hair, but if that be the case, it flies in the face of the legislature's directive that this be construed liberally. It also, nowhere in the statute says that the owner of the building, structure, or improvement has to also be the owner of the real property, which has to read into that statute in order to make that interpretation fly.
The Legislative Reference Bureau, the Wisconsin Bill Drafting Manual, suggests that, since legislation today is in printed form, punctuation is supplied by the drafter and read by legislators, and the rules of punctuation have crystallized enough so that punctuation can be helpful in conveying meaning. The threshold question, as I see this case, is are we defining property as two categories, which is real property with those other things and water, or three categories? And it bothers me, I just look at the very next thing, when we're dividing after F comes G, when we're defining recreational activity. Now that means outdoor activity undertaken for purpose of exercise, comma, relaxation, or pleasure. And I'll put a period there just because for purposes of my point, I don't need the rest of the sentence. If you're having three things, you put a comma after the first one that you're listing. Now, there's an exception to the rule if you're using conjunctions, but by looking at G, you see that's the rule the drafters are using. You put a comma after the first one. The way that the punctuation is set up in F indicates only two categories, not three.
Justice Bradley, I'll agree with you that the building structures or improvements have to be on real property. They are in this case.
Well, that's not my question. The question is the way the punctuation is set forth in F, it speaks of two categories, not three. Now, you can argue about don't and other things, but I'm just talking about punctuation. Do you agree with that or disagree? And if you disagree, tell me what I have said wrong with regard to the rules of punctuation.
Well, this may be a semantic argument, but it includes real property if there's no improvements on it. It includes the improvements on real property. Now, if you want to...
I'm focusing on punctuation. And so I'd like you to confine your answer to punctuation.
I disagree.
Okay.
I disagree. I state that my opinion is that the statute applies to real property and to any improvements on the real property.
And can you tell me why, from punctuation, that would be, since you earlier said that a comma comes after the first item as a rule of punctuation? Yeah, there are variations on that, but that's what...
The legislature intended that the improvements must be on real property. Real property and improvements.
Now, you're getting to purpose. I'm talking about plain meaning, looking at the text and looking at the punctuation as part of the text. Keep away from purpose, because we don't get the purpose if we have, arguably, if we have the plain meaning from the text. What does a comma after the word thereon suggest to you? That we've ended the first item in the series?
Water from the state are not normally considered real property. I would not construe them as real property, and therefore the comma is put there, in my opinion, to distinguish the real property, the land and improvements, from waters of the state. It is an additional category.
And we're dealing with a definition, a legal definition, whether you consider property water property or not. Can you help me with, can you rebut, help me get off this issue, because it seems so clear to me when you have three things listed, after the first one you put a comma, and then you can or you cannot after the second one. That's, you said, the rule. With that interpretation here, you only have two categories.
And I guess I just respectfully disagree. To me, it is real property, and then the next category is the improvements on real property, whether or not there is a comma there or not. Nothing in the statute nothing says that the improvements have to be on property owned by the person who put the improvements there. Nothing. That's what he's reading into the statute. The statute talks about the real property and the improvements on real property. We have improvements on real property, and nothing in the statute says that we have to be the underlying owner of the real property. In fact, the statute says that a lessor who does not own the underlying real property is entitled to the immunity. An occupier is entitled to the immunity. As a matter of fact, the statute says an employee of the lessor is entitled to the immunity. An officer of the lessor, he is another step removed from actually owning the underlying real property. That's the disagreement I have with them, is they are reading into the statute the requirement that the improvements have to be on property owned by the person who built the improvements, and there's nothing in there. In fact, the statute is quite to the contrary, because it allows lessors, it allows occupiers, it allows officers and employees all the immunity.
So your reading, though, would be, and if you look at sub F, your reading would be this: property means real property, and then you would put that as the first category, put a comma there. That's the first category. And building structures and improvements thereon, comma, which already is there, and the waters of the state. Is that the way that you read it?
I would read it exactly as that, except I don't think you have to put the comma there to come to that conclusion. And that's what the Court of Appeals came to also, that there are three categories of property: real property, building structures and improvements, and water. That's how I read it, and that's how they read it. And I don't think you need a comma to do that, because there's clearly a difference between dirt, ground, and improvements.
So this violates the rule, and all grammatical rules can be violated, but this violates the rule of grammar that you put a comma after the first one.
I don't think so, with all due respect, I disagree. Getting back to my argument, then, we're looking for a bright line test, and the easy way to do it is to, this is unquestionably our property, they admit we own it. It is property under the definition of the statute. It is property under the definition advanced by the Court of Appeals. It is property under the definition of property used in the statutes of the state of Wisconsin. It is personal property. This is a structure. It is a structure that's permanently attached. The plaintiff was on our property, admittedly engaged in recreational activity, and he was injured. And if you want a bright line test, you simply have to read the statute in a straightforward manner. You add to that the gloss that this is to be liberally construed to protect people who own property, like Gerald Shaw, and the application of the statute, to me, is relatively straightforward. As this court has said in other decisions, the focus is always on not the nature of the property, whether the property is open or not open. The focus is always on the activities of the person who claims to have been injured. The focus here, if you put it on that, is clearly favors immunity, because Mr. Peterson was clearly engaged in a recreational activity. As I pointed out earlier, the statute does not require that the owner of the improvement also be the owner of the underlying real property. If you look at the statute, it gives immunity not only to owners of the real property, but also lessors of the real property, occupiers of the real property, and also agents, servants, and employees or officers, agents and servants of the owner of the real property, or of the owner of the property that's built on the real property. So there's nothing in the statute that requires that there be a unity of ownership between the underlying real property and the improvement on it. And that's what they're trying to read into it. And that rewrites the statute and also violates the legislature's intention that it be liberally construed.
What's the purpose of this statute?
Recreational immunity statute? To encourage people to allow their property to be used by others for recreational purposes.
Dome that you cited before states at page 350, to encourage property owners to open their land for recreational activities. Would you agree with Dome on that?
I agree that's what it says, and I agree that there are a lot of decisions that use the term open their land for recreational purposes. You'll find about half the decisions use that language.
And
the other half simply say property.
The urban case that came out last term, the principle that the purpose of the legislation is to encourage landowners to open their property.
Yes, I agree that that's what it says. There's also the Linville case that says the court must liberally construe the statute in favor of property owners, not landowners, property owners.
But Linville also, I think, speaks of opening their lands for recreational activities, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I think,
does.
In fact, quote right from Linville, to encourage property owners to open their lands.
I agree. The terms have been used interchangeably. Now here's a case where it presents the issue firsthand, where we have to concentrate on the difference between owner of the land and owner of the real property. Take a look at the Crowbridge case. It's Crowbridge versus Village of Egg Harbor, I think it is, where the Village of Egg Harbor put a municipal pier out over the waters of Green Bay. Now, they don't own Green Bay. They don't even own the land under Green Bay. Those are all held by the state of Wisconsin in trust for its citizens. But they constructed this structure, this pier, out over the land that they don't own. And the Court of Appeals held that there was immunity in that case. And they didn't have much difficulty finding that there was immunity in that case. It's exactly the same situation here. Here, we built a structure on land we don't own. This Village of Egg Harbor in that case didn't particularly maintain that. They didn't use it on a regular basis. It was put out there for other people to use. And the Court of Appeals had no difficulty finding recreational immunity in that case, even though it was something they owned, a structure that wasn't on land that they owned.
Was that a case that involved 8115? I forget. And in terms of sidewalks, want of repair, and the whole issue in that case was whether or not that came under the 8115 obligation. Isn't that right?
That certainly was one of the issues in that case. I agree with you. I agree with you. But the application of the rule is exactly the same. I mean, it is a structure that they owned, that they constructed on land that they didn't own, and recreational immunity applied.
They said that it wasn't a sidewalk?
They said there was some exception for sidewalks, and the court held that the recreational immunity statute trumped whatever the sidewalk statute was.
Could I ask you, Mr. Moore, on this question of whether there are two categories of property or three categories of property, if the court were to conclude there, the statute implies two categories of property, is that fatal to your position?
No, not at all. I don't think so. Because there's nothing in the statute that says that the person who owns the building structure and improvement has to also own the real property. In fact, it's quite the contrary.
lessors have the protection, occupiers have the protection, officers and agents of lessors have the protection. It is not fatal by any means. I just disagree philosophically with Justice Bradley, who said that, that's one category of property. It isn't, in my opinion. It connotes the dirt, the earth, and the improvements on it, which to me are two different categories of property, whether or not they are conjoined by a comma or an
if there are two categories, then your argument is under the occupier language as opposed to the owner.
I don't think we have to, no, I don't believe we have to get to the issue of occupier. I think if we get to the occupier, we still win, but we don't have to get that because we're the owner of property.
But if you're not, if there are two categories, you don't own real estate.
Correct.
So if there are two categories, you cannot fit within the first of the two categories. So as the owner of real estate, so you have to go as to...
If it is your belief that the owner of the improvements also has to be the owner of the real estate, then yes, I don't fit into that. But there's nothing in the statute says that. And so I do believe that I fall under the protection of the statute because I am an owner of property. Stripping away all the lawyers' arguments, I mean, if we came to this thing cold and fresh and looked at it, is that a tree stand a structure? Yes, they don't even raise that issue any longer on their appeal. Is it property? Yes, it is an improvement. It is unquestionably property under the definition of the statutes. We are the owner of the property. That's admitted in their brief. He was on our property when he hurt himself engaged in a recreational activity. There is a bright line test. You don't need to split hairs about how often was he out there, did he maintain it, did he use it every year, did he use it only deer hunting season. It was out there, there was some degree of permanence. He had not abandoned it. No one made that argument anywhere along the line that he had abandoned it.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Why do they have anything about building and structures when it only covers outdoor activity?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the first
Why part. Is there anything in the statute about buildings and improvements and structures when the only recreational activity that's covered is outdoors?
Well, I guess because one can be engaged in an outdoor type recreational activity on a structure.
Like this one.
Like climbing on a piece of jungle gym equipment.
How about can you be engaged in a recreational activity within a building?
I would imagine one could, although as I sit here and think about it, I can't give you...
I mean,
right
with
now,
the structure, you can say, sure, you know, but hard, if you have these three separate categories, a building is legally property under, you know, of course a building is property, we all know that, but we're talking about a legal definition under this statute. Is the third category, a building is property under this statute. Now, recreational activity means outdoor activity. Does that make sense that a building would be considered property if recreational activity is only for out of doors?
Well, if a person, for example, was out picnicking, which is recreational activity, and went under the cover of a picnic shelter, one could argue that he was in a building and yet still engaged in a recreational activity. I've seen picnic shelters that are open on only one side and enclosed on three sides. That's still a recreational activity. It's still arguably outdoors. I guess we're debating that issue. I think one can be technically within the confines of a building and yet still be engaged in a recreational activity.
Well, suppose you eliminated all those words about building and structure and just had real property in water. Would it cover the tree stand?
If we had to be the owner of real property, no, we would not, because we are not the owner of the real property.
But you're an occupier. You're an occupier.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, yes, we are an occupier of the property for that purpose.
Same thing about the structure, the shelter structure.
If I understand,
city owned the real estate. Somebody else had put up the shelter.
and somebody was injured while using that shelter.
Yeah, the shelter still would be covered. You're an occupier of the real estate.
Right. Mr. Peterson had permission to be out there. He had carte blanche provision to be out there whenever he wanted. He had permission.
Who cares? Suppose he was a trespasser and put it up 20 minutes before. He's a carpenter, wasn't he?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Somebody was a carpenter here. Who was the carpenter?
He was a carpenter.
Okay. And suppose he put it up trespassing 5 hours before.
Well, he would definitely not be an occupier under those circumstances. Number one, he was trespassing. Number two, it was just constructed there. He wasn't given permission to be there. A person who is an occupier has to have some arguable claim of right to being there and has to have made some improvements and some continuity of use, all of which are present in this case.
So you're going to define occupant differently for him than you will in your case?
I thought my definition of occupier would be consistent for both. You asked if someone had trespassed on the property 5 hours
earlier. Have to have permission to be an occupant, is that right? And what were your other characteristics?
Permission, whether you have
claim of right, okay. And use for a period of time? Any other characteristics?
I'm reaching back to the example where the court said that somebody who goes in a fishing boat onto a lake is not an occupier of the lake because he's only using it for a brief period of time. What, he has no claim of right to use it.
Counsel, you know, there are other blinds other than deer stands there or hunting apparatus. There's duck blinds, goose blinds, turkey blinds, and I was just thinking that they're all occupied for very short periods of time. I mean, there's the building stage, and then what effect would this have on, we talk about the Doan case, which was out in the water. What about a duck blind, which is usually attached to the ground under the water? You can't have it way out. It has to be so far from the shoreline.
Well, if it's something other than a person just coming out, setting up a duck blind on public land and then leaving, which I would not construe to be an occupier, if he has permission from the owners of the land to construct something there and uses it on a regular basis, then I believe he's an occupier under the definition of the Turtle Lake case.
As you define property and as you apply the purpose to it, so let's say a structure with this tree stand. Purpose would be to encourage tree stand owners to open up their tree stand to others, or turkey blind owners to open up their turkey blinds to others. Is that what you're doing?
That's what I said before. The purpose of the statute is to encourage property owners to make open use of their property for recreation.
Should we withdraw the language in Urban of last year and the other case, and the many other cases that say that the purpose of the legislation is to encourage land owners to open their property? Because you're saying that's really incorrect. You're saying that if you define property as including structures and buildings, the purpose is to encourage people who have built a picnic structure or a picnic building. To open it up to others, and turkey blinds to open it up to others, and tree stands to open it up to others. That would be your understanding of the purpose of the legislation with your definition of property.
I don't think you have to withdraw the language landowners. I think the term was used loosely because in the context of that case it did involve just land. Here it involves improvements that are on real property. And I think now we have to focus on that particular issue, and I don't think there's anything inconsistent. Those cases involve land, and you used the term land. It was entirely appropriate in that case. But the statute really talks about property, not
is
about
it because
land.
The prior legislation specifically spoke of land that we still have? I mean,
that may be. The predecessor statute, which I'm not conversant with, may have dealt exclusively with land. But I with this statute, there was clearly a legislative intention to liberalize immunity for people who own property. And
now, if we should hold in your favor on the basis of immunity, do we have to get to misrepresentation and the dead man statute?
There are two other issues which we raised on appeal, and I haven't argued them yet, but I do think that the Court of Appeals should have looked at them. Of course, we won on other grounds, so the Court of Appeals never did look at it. But there is a serious question. Virtually the only evidence the plaintiffs presented in response to a summary judgment motion is the accident happened. We analyzed the liability situation very clearly, and there was no evidence presented that this thing was constructed in anything other than a good and workmanlike manner. And the plaintiff himself knew that wood rots, and he admitted that the only thing that the plaintiff said, or that the defendant said to him, was that the tree stand looked good, which he said was a true statement. It did look good. In fact, he tested it himself, and it looked good. And my advancement to the Court of Appeals, as it is to this court, is even if I lose on the recreational immunity statute, please take a look at the underlying liability case, because there was absolutely nothing presented in response to our summary judgment motion that suggested that there was any liability on the part of Harold Shaw, any actionable liability, or any actionable misrepresentation on his part.
So what's your position on summary judgment, that there isn't a dispute about the fact of negligence or misrepresentation?
The court never got to those. The court did get to the issue the trial court did, on summary judgment. And the court said there was a dispute of fact as to what the statement, "it looked good," meant. And that statement only deals with a misrepresentation claim. There was a claim of negligence, and there was nothing in the record that indicated that there was any negligence on the part of Harold Shaw in constructing that tree stand. And the Court of Appeal, or the trial court, didn't address that issue. It simply said that as to the statement, "it looks good," there are a number of ways that could be interpreted, and therefore I will not grant summary judgment.
If you win on immunity, the other two issues are gone. If you win on immunity, there's no need to remand.
Exactly.
You don't win on immunity, maybe on the negligence claim, it would fail on the summary judgment, if you are correct that there's no dispute on the facts. If you don't win on immunity, then it would go back on misrepresentation.
Correct.
Do I have that figured out right? Okay. In your opinion. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Rotier.
First, with respect to what the record shows on non-use of the tree stand, the record references are on page 3 of our brief. Mrs. Peterson, the co-owner of the property, testified that Mr. Shaw had not hunted from the tree stand for a number of years. She thought it had been 3 years. Vernon Peterson, the co-owner, testified that Mr. Shaw had not hunted for 3 years or so before the accident. That is the record. Mr. Moore referred to it as a permanent tree stand. There is nothing in the record to support that. It was cinched by a chain, and when the chain pulled through, it fell. Let me suggest one alternative way to deal with this grammatical issue, and that is to see which words you can take out of the statute and have it still read and make sense. Could you take out the words "real property" out of the definition of property? If you took those out, it would read, "property means building structures and improvements thereon." Thereon would mean nothing. Those three words are clearly modifying and supplementing the words "real property." You could take "real property" out in the balance, and it would make sense. And I think this is the legislator indicating they want to give some additional immunity to landowners who put structures on, such as a park shelter that was referenced earlier. With respect to the Trowbridge case, that case never addressed the issues we're addressing today. That had to do with whether a pier was a sidewalk, and the court said it was not. I am not saying to this court that the owner of a piece of personal property, which is placed on real property, can never enjoy immunity. But rather, it hinges on whether they fall within the definition of occupier. And that hinges on continuity of use, as this court has already recognized in a number of cases, and that to extend immunity even farther than it already has to personal property owners who place personal property out there and don't regularly and continually use it in a normal fashion extends immunity farther than is necessary, especially under circumstances such as this, and I'll close with this, absent questions. And this again is the record reference is shown in page 3 of our brief. Mr. Shaw did not have the right to invite people onto the property to hunt without Mr. and Mrs. Vernon Peterson's permission. So what public purpose in terms of encouraging opening of land would be served by giving Mr. Shaw immunity as opposed to continuing the immunity of Mr. and Mrs. Peterson, even for structures put there by others? Because they don't have, the Petersons don't have to be the owners of the personal property to retain their immunity. They have it because of the owners of the real property and the structures thereon, irrespective of who owned the structures.
But there's no question that Shaw gave permission to your client to use a tree stand.
That is correct. That is correct. And he had been introduced to the Petersons, and they gave him permission, and absent that, he would not have been allowed on the land. Finally, and one last thing, on the Snow Eagle case, the suggestion that the extent of involvement of the snowmobile clubs somehow compared to the extent of involvement Mr. Shaw had with his tree stand, in that case, I'm quoting, Snow Eagle secures permission from the landowners to construct trails across their property. Snow Eagles then does whatever is physically necessary to create snowmobile trails on the property. Once the trail is constructed, signs are placed. After a trail is built and the signs placed, headwater personnel groom it on a regular basis. No issue was present there whether or not that immunity enjoyed by those snowmobile clubs would exist 3 years later, absent continued exercise of contact and utilization of that property. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Otier. Thank you, Mr. Moore, for your arguments here this morning. And Lamp leads the argument on 99-2987, Peterson versus Midwest Security Insurance Company. And I will call the second.